morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Lots of different stuff coming up in the show today. We're going to be speaking about restorative justice, and we're going to be speaking about dogs. And right now, I'd like to welcome Jane Davis, who is going to be speaking to all of us about this. She is the founder and director of Hope House. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Great to be back, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you, too. We've had you on a few years ago to talk about Hope House. It is time sort of for an update. But first of all, what is Hope House, and how did you found it?
Hope House was founded after I witnessed an electric chair execution in Georgia as media.
And you were invited to an execution. You were invited to be witness to an execution.
I was invited to an execution. I was a contributing writer to Prison Life magazine. And at that time, you have to have a certain number of media witnesses at every execution.
That's the law? Those are the rules?
Yes. Everywhere, in every state. So, and that's to make sure that everything's done, you know, by the book. And I never wrote about it. My work is not about the political aspect of the death penalty. It really blossomed. I had a vision. Hope House came literally.
Well, what happened? I mean, you witnessed this execution and it changed your life?
Yes. I had a moment. George Mitchell, who founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, they actually brought me to California and debriefed me about the vision aspect of it. It changed my life in that moment. I had this moment of all-knowing. The clarity that we're all connected. And so our tagline is, for Hope House, one heart. And I'll talk about that more, but that's why I'm so excited that restorative justice is happening in the community, where we're all involved in different ways. And so Hope House, 15 years ago we've existed, we're 501c3.
Which means a nonprofit organization.
Yes, and that's what brought me out here. This vision actually told me, Hope House is an acronym. Help other people evolve through honest, open, willing self-evaluation and expression. I didn't make this up. This woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it gave me all the aspects. And so we've kind of been grassrooting it along all these years, even though we're 501c3. We have the same volunteers, the same board for 15 years. And it's just about being of service. That's really, I don't get paid for being the founder and director. We all serve just this bigger message of peace and that we're all one. And that's really the essence of Hope House.
It's so interesting because it's an extremely unusual nonprofit organization and that it doesn't have a specific domain or mission. You basically help people who need help.
Well,
we have
and
animals,
dogs, right?
I was going to say, people, four-legged people.
Four-legged, two-legged. But it's not just people, you know, it's when we say people who need help, that implies there's a them and us. What our mission is, that we actually exist to foster peace through honesty, faith, and action. That is, we do have a mission, but it is very grassroots. We had monthly potlucks, which kind of went away for a little while, and they'll come back soon. But it's recognizing that you and I, you know, we need help. We need support. There is no them. It's just us. And when we actually share honestly about ourselves, and that goes into our sex lives, our things that make us sad, things that make us angry, all those human things. You sit down and you really talk from that perspective, there's a joining, there's a bonding, and you realize, I'm no different from you.
So then, really, it's a service. I mean, you are serving people who, by some interpretations, really do need help more than you or I do.
Sure.
But on the other hand, there's an equality in it, the way you are framing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So that's the principle is, you know, that we all need help and support. And we do. I'm sure there are moments when you're in your, you know, home alone and you're depressed and you're sad and you feel alone. You feel like a loser. I mean, I know I do, you know, and then it's like, that's not a reality. But I need to be able to call someone and just say, this is how I'm feeling right now. And that person just understands. In restorative justice, in the peacemaking circles, you know, it's like you pass a talking stick around. And also in 12-step programs, there's no crosstalk. And these things are incorporated so as not to bring shame to anyone. You just are heard. And that's a lot of the work of Hope House that we do. And we do a lot of work in the prisons, both in Atlanta, Georgia, and here. We're one of the largest suppliers of volunteers to corrections. And one of the shifts that's happening, also I just want to back up a minute, because when we work in the prisons, and again, this is where Hope House and restorative justice really blend in terms of our philosophy and the work we've been doing and what restorative justice is, accountability is huge. So people sometimes think, because we work with people on death row, or they'll say, well, what about the victims? Well, we work with victims also. Again, there's no separation. It's not like we just work with offenders in Hope House work. And I'm also, personally, I've shared in the past about this, but, you know, I'm a family member of a victim. My grandfather was practically eaten alive by a heroin addict when I was 16 years old. And that was my first encounter with violence, so I understand.
Somebody broke into his apartment,
yes,
and nearly killed him.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, we were making the funeral arrangements, and we were told he was not going to make it, and it was a miracle that he did. But, you know, for 4 days, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I had to emotionally go through the death of my grandfather. He was never the same again, but he survived.
And I find it amazing that even at that time, at the age of 16, you were able to look at an act of violence against somebody who was your own blood, who you loved, with a perspective that had some compassion for the perpetrator who never was caught.
Well, and that's correct. And it was so, you know, at 16, you learn how good people are. And, you know, it was my first experience like this. So I was practicing all of those principles that I was taught up until 16. And I couldn't get out of my mind what was wrong with the man that did this, you know. And I just had this flash that if we don't want this to happen, because I was sat in my grandfather's apartment. I mean, it was, paintings were slashed. There was blood all over the place. It was so violent and horrible, gruesome. And that's what my thoughts were. Well, if we don't want this to happen to anyone, which, who does? Of course you don't. Then you have to sit and talk to the person who did it, which probably is not a coincidence that I end up being a social worker and, you know, working in a prison. So
now you had...
that's my day job.
Right, you were in the prison, in your day job is working at the penitentiary.
Correct.
Here in Santa Fe.
Right.
You were approached by some young people, including a young man in Atlanta named Rod Dupree.
Yes.
Tell us his story.
Well, Rod is a miracle. Rod is my unofficially adopted son. And Rod was 14 years old in juvenile jail. When we met, he sent a letter out into the world, really asking for help. And he sent it first to the Human Kindness Foundation. And he said, if you're in that business, then, you know, I'm your client. And they wouldn't touch him. He was a young African-American gang violent member of the community, and nobody would touch him. So the letter came to me with attitude, like, here, you'll work with anybody. And I said, thank you for knowing that. And so I wrote to Rod, and I said, here are the rules. Here's how Hope House works. You know, you have to be accountable. It's about you doing the work. And I said, this is not a codependent thing. You know, you have to do the work. I'll be by your side every step of the way if you want it. So today, Rod is 24. He literally just came off what's called off paper. He's off probation for the first time. Had he done anything against his parole or probation, if he violated, he would have been sentenced as an adult. And that would have been a whole other journey. He's married. His wife is pregnant with their second child, and he's made it. He has a job, and it was like all odds were against him.
And the key was having somebody to talk to.
Yes. And so I believe that the key was absolutely that principle. Again, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, Jane, you did this. And I go, I didn't do anything. I practiced the principle, and if you find that attractive to you, then you do it. That's the purpose of Hope House. Really, to be examples of showing up for each other, just being there, and holding others accountable and responsible, all of us. So I know.
So in a relationship, for example, like the one you have had all these 10 years with Rod Dupree, did you hit some sticky points with him where it was tough?
You know, it's so funny. The stickiest point. And he comes to visit here, and he'll be here again later this year. As a matter of fact, he called me. He has a vacation in May, and so he just needs time alone. But the stickiest time that he and I had was when he was here visiting. It was a couple of years ago, that trip, and I put him to work because we were having a big Hope House weekend. And so I put him to work weeding. We needed someone to weed so that the place would look good. And it was in the summer, it was hot, and he was so mad at me that at one point he kind of just lost it, and he went for a walk, you know. And we had...
That's pretty tame, Jane.
No, well, it really was. I mean, that was the biggest thing, I think. You know, our relationship, he calls me every week still. He always did. From the time he was in juvenile jail, he called. And even there were moments when I would want to call him sometimes, and I just didn't. I mean, once in a while I did, because I wanted him to feel, you know, the loving energy, of course. But I knew he had to do the work, especially at the beginning, and he did.
We're talking to Jane Davis, founder and director of Hope House.
And so we had... back in Atlanta, there were other adolescents that also came and lived. We had Jelaine, who is my unofficially adopted daughter, lived with us in the house for 9 months. And she came from the streets, and she came and lived with us, and she was amazing. And today, to this day, also, she's now 24, and, you know.
Turned her life around.
She did. She did.
Now, you also take in animals, especially dogs.
Yes.
The superior of all possible pets.
Yes. And we do, it's, again, you know, showing up is showing up. Service is service. You know, people go, oh, you know, you do prison work or you do. I encourage people to think outside the box. You know, that's just think of the principle and the word, and that's what we do. And, two of the dogs that I kept that we've rescued, Hogan and Magic, are also both, well, Hogan was here on the show with Patsy Swenson.
That's right.
Hogan is an official Delta Society dog. They're therapy dogs, not service dogs, but they both also do their service, and they come in the prison with us, and they bring love and goodness. A couple of years ago, there was a dog named Gus who had been shot and was near dead and crawled his way to the home of a wonderful, wonderful woman
named Laszlo Lazowska, who joins us right now. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell us the story of this dog that crawled up to your house near dead.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Brave Gus, as we call him, and I had dubbed him Gus. He was a feral, kind of a free-roaming dog out in the on the mesa where I used to live out near Madrid, and he would come into my yard for months and come in for a day and leave, and he'd play with my dogs, but I could only approach him, you know, the distance of about 100 feet. He's very timid. Well, one Sunday afternoon, in fact, March 26th, 2 years ago, he wandered into my yard, and I noticed, I looked out the window, and he was limping. Then I looked again, and I saw what horrific injuries he had. He had been wandering for 3 days, we believe, the vets thought, about 3 days, with horrific injuries.
Somebody'd shot the dog.
Well, we now believe that it was an automobile. We had several theories going on at the time, and we now believe it was an automobile incident, perhaps someone intentionally caused harm to the dog, wanted to. But in any case, it was inspiring in a way because he was so timid before, but he was at his wit's end, I'm sure, and he needed help. And he allowed me, after about an hour and a half or 2 hours, I literally got on my stomach on the ground because he was so timid and coaxed him. My sister happened to be living with me at the time, and she brought out every scrap of food out of the refrigerator we could possibly find to lure him so that I could get close to him. And after about 2 hours, I was able to put my arms around him, approach him, touch him, very gradually, step by step. cradle him in my arms. He was about a 40-pound dog at the time. Pick him up. I was able to put him in my vehicle and then drive him into the Santa Fe Emergency Clinic on St. Francis Drive. Phenomenal care he received there. And then he went over to Smithvitz for 3 days after that and had several surgeries, one to the paw. He lost part of a paw and he lost an eye. And that's how Jane and I knew Jane for months previous to this event.
From the Breakfast Club in Surrios.
Exactly.
So how did Hopos enter into the story of Gus the Brave Dog?
Well, because we had met at the Surrios Breakfast Club has been around for years. And we met there, and immediately Laszlo and I knew we were soulmates in service. And she was very interested in being part of Hope House, and we were very interested in doing whatever we could together. And so when this happened, our paths crossed, and we had been talking about doing grant writing, and we sent Laszlo to a grant writing workshop, and then all of a sudden, in the midst of all this, Gus appeared, and it was like, wow, well, we can help raise funds for the vet bills. And so I want to thank everyone out there from Hope House, and you know, who just community members, everybody pulled through, and we raised money and also accepted funds to pay for the vet bills for Gus.
I literally, that Sunday afternoon when I had this dog in my vehicle driving to the emergency clinic on a Sunday, I have animals, I know how expensive these things can be. I literally thought, how am I going to do this? And I had to help this dog. I mean, there was no question. And I thought of Jane. And I thought of Hope House, and Hope House was key, was central in this, in that Jane was able to administer and help with donations coming into the not-for-profit, and volunteers came forward, and of course a greater call went out to the community. We had many people like PAWS, Jane Carson at PAWS assisted, the Animal Alliance assisted.
Now you still have the dog?
I do. I'm the Gus bus driver.
And I remember at the juncture where Laszlo, you know, it was like, okay, now, you know, now what do we? Now that Gus is kind of, you know, okay, and we were going to help find a home. I had considered, you know, okay, because Gus was, I mean, just so awesome a dog. And then I said to Laszlo, do you really understand though? Gus is yours. And Laszlo at that point had like 6 horses and 10 dogs. And, you know, she has a huge heart.
4 dogs. And, there really is a difference.
She questioned whether she could even accept another animal. And I just said, you can. And one of the things I just want to point out that also Laszlo is starting Windhorse Institute, which is utilizing, you know, she has rescued Morgans, the Mustangs. Mm-hmm. And Hope House, we've turned down 5 Mustangs because we don't yet have the space, although we did just get 20 acres of land off the grid. So, you know, we're aiming towards, you know, we need support to build the barn and the fences and get the well. But Laszlo and I are committed to this work. And that's something Hope House, we want to build the animal aspect of our service work. And so we hope to really work closely with Laszlo because we're both just so committed, as the Santa Fe community is.
Now, and Wednesday is Brave Gus Day by proclamation of the mayor of Santa Fe, which
yes.
is hilarious.
We're very excited about that. You know, the event 2 years ago was so inspiring. On one level, this dog that was feral, that I couldn't approach him within 100 feet, came to me essentially for help.
And now is he basically a good little doggy lap dog, comes in the
suit? He loves people. He's wonderful. He's timid around some people, but he's wonderful. It was an epiphany for him, this little dog soul.
Yes.
But it was also wonderful, Mary Charlotte, and so inspiring for me because of the community outpouring to help the dog and to help me. And at the time, I thought this March 26th will forever be a really amazing day for me. I'll never forget March 26th. So last year, we wanted to do something. It was kind of an email thank you campaign.
Right.
So I approached, I decided I really want to do something, a little reception or something. So I approached Debbie and Jack Funfer, who own Heart of the Lotus Interiors on Montezuma in Santa Fe, and they're wonderful people, they're animal advocates. And I said to them, how would you like to have a Brave Gus Day celebration with me? And I told them the story, and they said, absolutely, we'd love to do that. So the day is we intend that March 26th be
an annual. That's Wednesday.
Annual
Brave Gus Day.
Annual Brave Gus Day, and it is truly for the entire community. It is a celebration. It is a tribute and a thank you to all our animal welfare organization.
And anybody can show up.
Because
definitely.
I think, you know, what we've talked about is that the day really, and Brave Gus Day, and the celebration represents a thank you. It's a day for all of us who work with the animals and love the animals. And Gus is just a representative. And he'll be there, correct?
And it's at, oh, the dog himself will be there, Gus.
Because there will be an animal interpreter who's going to tell Gus's story.
An animal communicator.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is at 322 Montezuma, just off of Guadalupe, in Santa Fe, on Wednesday of this week at what time?
At 5:30.
Mary Lou Cook is going to give the blessing.
The animal blessing.
The animal blessing. And Mayor Koss will be there.
And we have, actually the mayor can't make it, unfortunately, but Councillor Boucher may come and join us, we hope, for a few minutes. But the intent of it, if I can quote our mayor, the intent of Brave Gus Day is to pay tribute to the many rescues, known and unknown, where Santa Fe citizens have reached out a hand and a heart to a fellow being in need. So that's the true intent, and it's going to be our celebration from 5:30 to 7:30 is going to be a fun, entertaining. We have a fellow from Española who is an aspiring film actor, Lucas Corbata's a stand-up comic, and he's going to do comedy for us, and we're going to have music. And there'll be an opportunity. I've invited some 20 animal welfare organizations in the community as special invited guests, and there'll be an opportunity for them to take the mic for a few minutes and share their mission, share any projects they have coming up.
And all of this at Heart of the Lotus Interiors at 322 Montezuma on Wednesday at 5:30. This brings up a question for me about your work, Jane, which is that there is... there are so many disasters that happen in the world because of human ignorance or uncaring. And then you come along and doing sort of, you know, so to speak, putting out fires is a different kind of work than preventing those fires in the first place, or is it?
I don't think there's much of a difference. Again, I go back to the principle. And the principle of service, I think that the key is when you do any kind of altruistic work and any kind of service work, you have to walk a fine line of not falling into codependency. And so I've done enough work over the years. I always go, I'm the least codependent. And that's why, like with Rod, I said, you know, hey, you have to do the work. And so as long as you set boundaries, you know, I have no illusions at all. You know, that I help anybody. It's like, but I understand that being of service is just a beautiful principle to practice in one's life. So it's being of service just crosses all boundaries as long as you have your own boundaries.
The time is 8:31 here on KSFR Santa Fe Public Radio. We're actually going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. And Laszlo Lazowska, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll be back in just a few minutes. I'd like now to welcome Irma Cedillo. She is the Deputy Secretary of Operations for New Mexico State Corrections. And we're continuing with Jane Davis, founder and director of Hope House. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. Good morning.
So the second part of our show is dedicated to talking about restorative justice. And let's start again with you, Jane. What is restorative justice? It's not one thing. There's all different things that come under that label.
And right now, restorative justice essentially is restoring justice, restoring peace in communities where every single aspect of anyone affected by crime is part of the process. And so again, it ties into the principles of Hope House of accountability and communication, and a very supportive, it can be a circle. Right now in the Santa Fe community, there is some confusion and there's lots of restorative justice going on, which is very exciting. And what we're here to talk about today is the reparative panel model of restorative justice, which is a reentry program for people coming out of prison. There's also a separate restorative justice that a lot of people are familiar with, which is victim-offender mediation. And there's another one called peacemaking circles. A lot of the community members in education recently went through training with Kay Pranis, who wrote the book on restorative peacemaking circles. Hope House is hoping to bring her back in September to also have a part of it on our land, which I referenced earlier, off the grid, to have very indigenous peacemaking circles with her. And what I want to really just applaud today and give a moment of incredible praise to Irma Cedillo, who's with us today, who she really spearheaded and said, we need this in our community, in corrections and prisons, which most people know, you know, doing anything innovative is, it takes a lot. You know, and we do innovative things in our prison system, but I'm just so proud to work with Irma and be affiliated really with our system.
Irma Cedillo, what was it that made you feel that you need a new model, that you need a restorative justice component in the prison system?
Well, every day I hear that we're not doing enough for these offenders, or we're not, these programs aren't working. So Tom Molina, who's our resident expert on restorative justice, he lives in Taos, New Mexico. I've been working with him for several years on other projects, and he told me about this particular project that was started in Vermont with the then Governor Howard Dean, who promoted these community reparative panels, is what they're really, really called. So it repairs the harm that's been done to the community by the offender. And I just jumped on it. I said, I want to do that in New Mexico, and that's my goal.
What were they actually doing in Vermont?
Well, actually, it's pretty much what we're talking about. What we're doing in New Mexico now is community members, volunteers from the community get together, and they serve as a panel to talk to the offender when they come out of prison, to help them in their communities, to help them readjust and reintegrate back into their community. The premise of it is that the more anonymous the offender is, the more likely that offender will reoffend. So the less anonymous he or she is, then that person's visible and they have more of a buy-in to their own community. They feel more a part of their community than ever before. So if, like especially in small communities, but we're doing this in Albuquerque too, but if they see them in a small community, they go, oh, I know you. You know, how can I help you? That kind of stuff. Instead of, I know you. You belong to in jail right now. So that was the idea and the premise of the whole thing to get.
So it's not only that they're not anonymous; it's that they're seen in a different context, which includes, you know, respect and caring to at least some extent.
Right. And accountability.
Yeah, accountability. You'd be surprised because, like Jane was saying, there's different models of restorative justice, and one of them is called a sentencing circle that the retired Judge Peggy Nelson in Taos was doing, especially with juveniles. But the community gets together and they sit in a circle, and they with the offender and the victims, if the victims want to be there, and they determine what the sentence is for that offender. You'd be surprised at how I shouldn't say easy, but how understanding they are about the offender's sentence. And they may go lighter on that offender, or they may say, well, you just get 1 year and we'll help you when you get out. So it's just interesting how when people from the community get involved in the justice process, which is changing the justice project drastically by doing these things, they're more understanding. It's incredible.
And, you know, one of the things, as I said earlier, I mean, Hope House, we've been doing this model in terms of the acronym of Hope House, and what you're seeing in the restorative models is the same thing. People want to be heard. And again, when you're connected with others, that model of one heart and accountability, it makes a difference. And so, you know, all these things are said in different ways. And when Kay Pranis, we met for a long time, and she said Hope House is a restorative justice model in the acronym and the practice. And so it's very exciting because the basic principle is we all want to be heard.
Well, now, I just wanted to say that this isn't just a Hope House project.
Right.
It's a Corrections Department project.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's just not... I appreciate that Jane is representing Hope House, but we're doing this all over the state as well.
Now, the whole thing about having your story told and heard, what role does that play?
As far as the offender?
As far as the offender.
Well, the offender has to volunteer to do this anyway, participate. So we think, corrections or myself, we think that if that offender is at that point where they want to participate in this program, then they're ready to change. And not only being heard, but knowing that people care, because they go through a system, could even be the juvenile system and the adult system, where they feel, I mean, I'm sure they feel this way, I'm not speaking for them, this is what I think, that they don't think anybody cares, nobody can, you know, reach out to them, help them, that kind of stuff. And when they're ready for this, that's when they actually get it, and that's when they really go, they go back to their communities, no doubt. They don't run to California or other states. They usually end up going back to where their family is. So that way they're a part of that community. And I really think they want to be. I think they realize, or the panel tries to help them realize what destruction they have done along the way. Not only to the victim, not only to the community, but those people who were sitting on that panel. It reaches and hits everybody, crime does. So it makes them more aware.
And in Vermont, where this, actually it's just recently I was told that they now can claim that they've affected the recidivism rate by 23% in Vermont through these panels.
That's
and
huge.
And so it's huge. Mm-hmm. It's huge. So it's here it is. We're doing something that's going to make a difference in the community.
Well, our recidivism rate right now in New Mexico corrections is about 46%, which is rather low compared to other states. We have, in our prison system, 60% of our inmates are violent offenders. And compared to other states, that's really high. Other states have about 40%. So you figure if our recidivism rate is about 46%, and we can impact it by even as much as 10, 15, even 20%, wow. You know, then just the violent offenders, we hope, will just be the ones in prison. And we can even help them when they get out, I'm sure, too.
Now, the people who would be eligible for this program, would they be violent offenders or only nonviolent?
It depends on the community. Now, Santa Fe, we're meeting on Thursday. What time?
Thursday, 5:30 at the downtown branch of the public library in the community room.
This is something that the public is invited to?
Oh, yes.
Oh, the public. Well, I think, and Irma has stressed this point, which is true, this is not a Hope House program. This is a community grassroots program. And really what will happen on Thursday night, 5:30 to 7:30, it's a time for the whole community to get educated. And one of the things that makes the reparative panel model work is bringing your heart. And I know Santa Fe is filled with people with big hearts who care. And that's really what I've been told made the Vermont, model work so well. That even people have come and been on panels who are police officers or probation officers, but they're not coming as their label. They're coming as a community member. And so everything that transpires from Thursday night will come a steering committee. From that steering committee, then the next group is the panels, and there are going to be four or five community members on the panel, and
for each offender, person getting out of prison, essentially.
Correct.
So basically, let's just to so people can understand the process. Somebody's in prison for whatever their crime is. They serve their time. They get out.
On parole.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have to be on parole. They could discharge from their sentence, too. So
right.
It's up to the community to decide who meets their qualifications to serve, to be on the panel, I mean, to participate on the panel.
Right. And so then they have the choice to participate on this reparative panel, community reparative panel.
Yes.
And on this panel are, like four community members?
Minimum three. People who volunteer who want to have it make a difference.
And then what do those people actually do? What is the relationship develops?
Okay. They get some intensive training, at least what I consider intensive, eight hours of training from Tom Alina, like I said, who is the expert, and he is contracted with the Corrections Department to do this training. But they get the training will help them talk to the offender, find out, what their needs are and stuff. But just reach the offender in a way that nobody has ever done in the community. Find out, like I said, what their needs are and not necessarily be a therapist. This isn't therapy. This isn't treatment. This is just reaching out. there's a point in time where the victim may want to appear at the panel or may not. We don't know. You know, that's up to each individual, panel and offender. The other part of it is it's bringing the family into the mix, too. The family members can be there. I've been on a panel, so I know from firsthand experience what it's like. And we had the mother and we had the offender and her mother and her son there. And it was, you know, it was very helpful. The mother needed just as much help as the offender.
Right, because she's just gone through this process of losing her son to the prison system, which is not exactly a easy thing.
And one of the people on the panel is a designated mentor. And as Irma said, not therapist, but a mentor. So that person might help get the person to an AA meeting.
Well, there's different, Jane, I'm sorry, there's different roles, and one of them could be mentor, but one is facilitator, too. Or they could be a combination thereof. I was, I would call this woman up, this ex-offender, just to see how she was doing, just to check in. Other panel members would, too. And like Jane said, you know, a mentor could, you know, help them out a little bit more than usual. But they're trained so that not to get too involved, there's a fine line.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that could be
dangerous.
Could get into dangerous territory as well. And then, so they meet in some place.
They could meet here at Santa Fe Baking for all, you know, it's a public place, the library. Some people in Albuquerque, they meet at Central New Mexico.
And is there a time limit to how many months or?
I think is it 6 months? I believe it's 6 months.
Yeah, I think it's 3 to 6 months.
Yeah,
minimum 3.
There's a woman that was in the panel, a participant in Albuquerque. I bring up Albuquerque because that's the first established one. They're actually established. We've got one starting up in Taos. But the woman actually decided with the panel to stay longer than the 6 months because she was benefiting so much. She didn't even want to leave. And she is now on the Governor Richardson's Prison Reform Task Force. So I'm so thrilled about that because I hope she'll push these reparative panels and maybe we'll get more attention to that as a result.
I think something like this depends on good faith of everybody involved. And obviously, if anybody is going to take the time to volunteer to be on a community panel like this, there's good faith. But what about on the part of the offender? Have you seen situations where the offender is kind of jerking people around?
Yes. I was on that panel, and it was one of the first ones we had at Albuquerque, and she was actually discharged, so she didn't have any. The pro board will not make any conditions of the offender to participate. Like I said, it has to be voluntary. This woman had no parole supervision whatsoever, so she was discharged from prison, which means she didn't have any time left on her prison term or her parole term. So anyway, she went on her own. And she was going sporadically, you know. I mean, she'd show up. And we had an ex-offender on our panel, by the way. And she knew what kind of game this woman was playing. We did help her somewhat, but we finally just said, look, if you're not going to take this seriously, we're not going to be wasting our time, and so to speak, to meet with you. So that was a failed attempt. But others have done really well.
I'd like to ask you, Irma, because I know that it took me a long time to understand this. And so a lot of listeners probably are very confused and do not understand when we're talking about off-paper, probation, parole. Could you just explain what's the difference between probation and parole
it's
and
confusing.
Off-paper?
It is confusing if you're not in the system. We talk like everybody understands our
right.
system.
Right, so this is a great opportunity.
Probation is usually when the judge gives them a chance, a second chance in court. And they can stay in the community. That's what probation is. Parole, I'm simplifying it, of course. And parole is once they've served time, they have up to 2 years parole time. Sex offenders, they're getting up to 20 years parole time. Sometimes, and this is where it gets confusing, the judge will impose probation when they get out of prison, so they'll have probation and parole terms to serve at the same time. And that's called a dual supervision case. So when they discharge, that means they have no supervision whatsoever. They're on their own. They don't have to answer to anybody. So.
Now, it seems like the prison system should be about helping people rehabilitate themselves and get ready to reenter society. But in a lot of cases, it seems like it just breaks people down more.
Well, we're supposed to do that. And I'm a former probation parole officer, so I know what kind of time it takes with each individual. So probation parole officers now have 100 cases. I mean, there could be a high-needs offender in there that can't get into what's called our community corrections programs, which handles more high-needs cases. Or maybe they're just you know, they're just too bogged down with the paperwork and the and all the work they have to do. So this helps them, actually helps them with their caseload,
I think. No, but I mean the prison experience itself, somebody sentenced to 1 year or 10 years or whatever, a lot of what one hears, I know I have one friend personally who went through that system for 2 or 3 years and was just a broken man by the time he got out.
Oh, yes. It's very traumatic, and they really do go through post-trauma once they're released, but they don't really know what's going on or they won't admit it. So, yes, this helps them. And the panel I was on, we told that one offender, go, you need some health screening, you need this. And sometimes they just have to be told by strangers, you know. And they'll listen rather than their family members, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's really helpful.
Is there a movement within the prison system to make the actual experience of prison, not so we're talking about the getting out part now, but the actual experience of being on the inside, something that's actually better for the human beings who are incarcerated?
Well, there's a lot of positive things we are doing, and much to, you know, everybody's surprise, we are doing some good things. We have a lot of programs. We have education programs. We have what's called therapeutic communities, which helps the offender with substance abuse. And in those therapeutic communities, we also have domestic violence programs. And then, like the education programs, they run the gamut from cable technicians to getting a degree, you know. I mean, they can get an actual degree in prison. There's other corrections industries programs. They're in textiles. They're in woodworking. And we need to do more. And we understand that.
And also in at Western and Grants, we have a meditation pod. Mm-hmm. And I've heard the officers actually don't like working there. Well, the inmates live in pods. But the officers sometimes say they're so bored because nothing ever happens. The inmates are so mellow. They don't get the
rush.
And so that's... And also, Irma is behind. We've been working with Hope House on doing a cell dog program, which is a community-based program working with the Humane Society, working with the community. And it would
getting
not
dogs.
Be service dog training, but it would be for obedience training, which would then make the dogs more adoptable. And so hopefully in the next few months we'll get that going.
We're already doing that in the prison in Grants with the women's prison there, and there it's called the Biscuit Program. And let me tell you, those dogs are so adoptable. I mean, I'm sure those women hate to let them go, but we have adopted some already.
And the women probably benefit quite a lot as well.
You bet.
Oh, yes.
And we've been trying to tell the administration, I mean, I'm part of the administration, but, you know, Jane's been trying to convince me and really, I'm for
No, I didn't have to convince you.
You didn't have to convince me, but...
Irma's great. You know, it's like, here's this innovative idea, and Irma's like, yeah.
Sometimes there's obstacles to these things, but yeah, we are definitely going to try and get it here at the Santa Fe Penitentiary for Hope House to be involved in.
I was talking to you, Jane, once some time ago about you. I mean, you work in the prisons. You work with people who are, you know, labeled sex offenders and all, you know, every kind of prisoner, people who've been through terrible things, done terrible things. And I, you know, and you and I were talking about forgiveness, and you said something which really struck me, which, and you said the greatest work of forgiveness that you witness is the prisoners themselves for having to try to learn to forgive the people who have abused them in their lives.
It's as a matter of fact, a lot of the sex offenders were sexually abused, and especially with men who are sexually abused, the tendency there is for them to take it out on others. So we see a lot of violent behavior. Women tend to get into abusive relationships. And this is not in stone. Of course, there's a gray, and it's not everybody. But there's a... And a lot of the sex offenders that I've worked with, that's what, you know, one of the biggest things in the therapeutic process is they're working on forgiveness and understanding that they have to forgive the person who abused them in order for them to move on with their lives. And it's very, very difficult for them to do.
Is that something that you try to play a role in facilitating?
Well, again, in when I do therapy, it's empowering another person. I don't have the answers. I can't do anything for anyone except empower them to do what they can for themselves.
I think in many ways it's a spiritual journey too that they have to find for themselves. I mean there's treatment, there's therapy, but there's also that personal side that they have to discover themselves. So it's a long process, I'm sure.
How do you see Irma Cedillo, the development of empathy. In other words, if you're going to be in a restorative panel, part of the process, I would think, is coming to see that the crime that you committed actually harmed other people and that that matters.
I think that's one of the toughest areas we're working with now with the reparative panels, because the panels are very new to this state, and we're getting a little more training on how to deal with the victims and how to deal with that sensitive issue with the offender, because, number one, they may be in denial like we talked about before, but they just don't realize the full impact, and that's why the community is getting involved in this justice new project, this new justice project. But to get them to that point, I think they just have to know that people care. And if they care, then I have to care about myself, too. It's like that part of the person that it's really hard to reach, but it's there, and they realize that they're very human. I think sometimes the community thinks that these people are just animals. And in some ways, you know, if they're off their meds and all that, maybe they are. But with these kind of panels, they're seeing the human element, you know, of that person, and vice versa. So, I mean, I know it sounds real, like, you know, nice and sweet and all that, but it's a challenge, too, for both sides to do this, to especially for the volunteer to dedicate their time to this. But it's also so fulfilling to know that maybe just helping one person will change the world, will help change, you know, their dynamic, their family relationships, et cetera, and it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I mean, every case like that has a ripple effect, and...
Sure.
There was a wonderful movie called The Sensation of Sight, which was at the film festival last year, and the thing that struck me so much about it was one person had committed an act of violence and was no longer there, and the ripple effect that had toward his parents, friends, teachers' friends, and everybody else, what just spread out in a way that was so terribly sad.
And that's why they're called reparative panels, to repair the harm. And, you know, hopefully that will happen. We're starting, like I said, in Taos, Roswell. I'm going tomorrow to talk to some people over there about reparative panels, Las Cruces, and, of course, Santa Fe. So we're excited about this, and hopefully some more. Yeah.
And so if people want to actually get involved, either see what's going on or consider volunteering for actually sitting on a panel, they can show up at the Santa Fe Public Library from 5:30 to 7:30 this Thursday.
Yes.
Right.
And you
the downtown branch.
Downtown branch
on Washington,
Avenue.
I'll be there.
You will both be there.
Yes.
And I believe the mayor will be there. Some of the council members will be there. And I think we're going to have a huge turnout, because I'm getting a lot of calls and questions. The other thing is, if people cannot make it Thursday night, they can call me at 827-8909 or 983-6677. And the 983 number is also the Hope House number. The first number is my number at Corrections. So if people are interested in what we talked earlier, getting involved with Hope House, 983-6677 or 827-8909.
And if they want to call me statewide, I mean, if there's somebody here listening from another part of the state, my cell phone is 670-0390, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
And if anybody has missed any of this, they can, of course, go on to SantaFeRadioCafe.org and actually listen to the show. And everything that we've said will be repeated from here until eternity.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
To those who want to listen. Irma Cedillo is Deputy Secretary of Operations for New Mexico State Corrections, and Jane Davis is the founder and director of Hope House. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.